If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Hi, this is David Asola, and you're listening to Whatever Nevermind.
Welcome to Whatever Nevermind. I am your host, Baco. Today I have part two of my interview with David DeSola. David was the author of the Alice in Chains book, Alice in Chains, The Untold Story. If you remember way back earlier on this countdown, at number 14 was the Alice in Chains record, Facelift. And kind of a companion to that was part one of my interview with David. We talked mainly about the time around the making of Facelift. Well, we just got into dirt here at number six on the list. And of course, today is part two. And we get into the time around the making of Dirt. If you liked part one, I guarantee you are going to love part two. This is a must listen for Alice in Chains fans. David and I get into all sorts of stories and anecdotes about the time leading up to the making of the record, and shortly after, stories that we culled from his book. So, and a lot of fun stuff to get into. Some not so fun stuff, but you get my drift. And remember, you can find David's book, Alice in Chains, The Untold Story, pretty much anywhere books are sold. So, but let's get right to it. Here you go, part two of my interview with author David DeSola. If you let yourself go and open your mind, I'll bet you'd be doing like me, and it ain't so bad. What's my drug of choice? Well, let's get back to the band a little bit. Lane actually enters rehab a little bit, either at the beginning or just before they go in to record Dirt, and that for his first time there. But Lane, he's the guy who gets Mark Starr going on a little bit of heroin here, if everything is correct.
Correct, yeah. So let me backpedal. So,
yep.
So the Van Halen tour starts in, I believe it's August of 91, right? And that tour goes, they're off and on that tour for the next couple of months, like into the beginning of 92, right? And, you know, at some point over there, Lane goes to rehab for the first time. And it's this, I can't remember the name of it. It's in the book, but it's the same clinic that Andrew Wood checked himself into a couple of months before he died.
Okay.
It's the same one, yeah. And the one or more.
They don't have a great track record at that point, then.
Well,
I know that's a bad joke. I said I was going to throw a couple at you.
One of the more heartbreaking stories I heard from my research was one of the main sources was Kathleen Austin, Denry's mother. So she went to visit him in. At this treatment center, and what happened, and apparently the other patients had figured out who Wayne was, and even though he wasn't a Kardashian or anything like that, he was the local celebrity.
Thank God.
And so somebody smuggled in a copy of the Live Faithless VHS cassette, and they were playing it in the rec room, knowing full well that he was a patient there.
Wow.
And,
that'd be kind of weird.
It was devastating. And it was just devastating. I mean, just, it was awful. And so by the time they go to California to make dirt in the spring of 92, remember, he's already been to rehab at least one that I know of. I mean, he went maybe about a dozen or so times overall in total in the course of his life. But he'd already been to rehab at least once. And he came back with some lyrics and some music that he had written while in rehab. Jordan called them his rehab songs. And that's the stuff he bought from the plate when he came into the studio. And so as far as Mike Starr goes, the story I heard was, so remember what I told you about how Mike Starr wanted more publishing?
Yeah.
So he had came up with this song called Fear the Voices, which he and Wayne wanted to record, and the other two guys weren't that crazy about. And he was pushing for it to be included on the record so he could get another publishing credit, right? And yeah. So they recorded it, but it didn't make the cut. And if you listen to the song, it's different than anything else on that album. It would have been totally out of place, right? But anyway, so they're recording this. So they're recording the song.
What did they call it? They called it Mike's Dead Mouse.
Yeah.
That's so kind of mean. Yeah, like Mike's bringing his mouse, dropping it in front of you.
Jordan said the joke was, Mike's dead mouse. It was like a kid in school, showing off his dead mouse to everybody. And everyone was just so fed up with it. They don't want to do good. They're like, no, stop this. So that was sort of the joke that, Mike wanted to do with song that was this song. And so they were in the studio recording. Wayne, Mike, and Brian Carlson, Jordan's engineer on that record, was working on, I guess it was that song, and Wayne goes to the bathroom, and I guess Mike goes with him, and they come back, and then a few minutes later, he runs out, and he throws up all over, the carpet in the studio lobby or something, or the lounge.
There's a lot of Mike puking stories, by the way.
Yeah. And so after they cleaned, what Brian told me was that after they cleaned everything up and they were talking about it, his recollection of that conversation was Mike saying that was the first time he had tried heroin.
Okay.
So I mean, I keep in mind, all three of them are dead, and that was my only source for that one. So whether it's true or not,
sure,
who knows, but that's, take it for what it is. That's the only account we have available.
Go ahead. Sorry.
And the other story about Mike's dead mouse was apparently, I guess Mike was either high or kind of being obnoxious or really persistent about, I don't know. But Wayne apparently had gone back to their apartment where they were staying in the mall area or something like that. And, and Mike called him and said, "Hey, man, can you come back to the studio to record these parts or whatever, blah, 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 blah." Like, I want you to look. And he's like, "Fuck you, and fuck you," whatever. And slammed the phone on him. Yeah, man, it's in the book. I'm trying to remember. I can't.
Yeah, something like that. It's like, fuck you and fuck your song. Basically, Lane was like, "I'm the only guy helping you with this, and now you're nitpicking my lead vocals on it." Yeah. That was kind of the tenor.
And that may have been a contributing factor in the decision to fire him. Who knows if it's true? Yeah. I don't know if it's true or not.
I've been in bands and I've worked with people, and I just got the vibe based on all the stories that were being told that Jerry never liked Mike. And then once they got big enough and rich enough, it just became like he was like this pain in the ass that Jerry kind of got sick of dealing with. And once there was a legitimate reason to kind of move on from him, he was ready to do it. Not saying I'm right.
I think never liked him might be overstating it.
Okay.
I do think that, at a certain point, Mike became more trouble than he was worse. So okay. That's probably why they decided to get rid of him. I think that would be a fair assessment. However,
well, but Lane was a lot of trouble. But I think Jerry and Lane connected a little more.
He was the sound of the band. He was the lead singer,
I suppose. You know? Yeah. I mean, I don't know, but you know, Mike's kind of a good-looking guy too. Maybe he's getting more chicks, and Jerry's all jealous.
Yeah, I mean that's what Mike said. Mike said, Jerry needed me on the end of the band or whatever. I don't know. It's one of those, he told so many different versions of why he got quit or that he got fired, whatever, but why he left the band. Jerry was jealous that he was getting more women and, yada, yada, yada. And I don't know. I mean, if you look at those early days of Alice in Chains, when Jerry moves up from Tacoma, they're brief. He meets Mike in that band. They're in a local band called Gypsy Rose for about, 2 or 3 weeks, right? And they were in that band for like 3 weeks. I don't know. Fast forward a couple months later when he's at the Music Bank and he decides to put a band together, right? And he gets Sean Kinney's number from Wayne Staley. And so they're talking and he's like, basically, one of the bass players, like, well, I knew this guy, Mike Starr, he's pretty cool, whatever. And then Sean, who was dating Melinda Starr at that point, was there with them when they first met.
That's right.
He was like, well, yeah, I know Mike since I was 12, and this is his sister, So it was like Jerry specifically asked for Mike Starr, or specifically Starr. So I don't think he never liked Mike mentality was ever there. I mean, remember, they all lived together in a house. They starred together. They played the clubs together. They did all this stuff together. I think the fairest explanation of it would be that Mike became more trouble than he was worth. And they ultimately decided that it was the best thing for the band for them to get rid of him.
Now you convinced me I'm wrong then. One thing about Lane, and you can talk about lyrically, but in interviews too, is that he doesn't really... He's not the typical addict. Like, there's not a whole lot of denial. It's almost like he skipped that stage and went straight to, he's like full blown. And a lot of these Seattle guys, it just seemed like they were naturally open, like, especially in the song lyrics about like what they were doing, why it was bad for them. And yet they couldn't seem to make any real effort or any real progress in getting out of their own way.
Well, two things. One, Lane was not, a poet laureate, right? He's not going to be T.S. Eliot. He's going to write what he knows.
Right.
And, so he knew addicts and withdrawal and getting high and all.
But he had a beautiful way describing dark shit.
Yes. Yeah, and conveying it vocally, right? Singing how he sang it, right?
So very much.
So keep that in mind. Number one, number two is all these guys are in a profession where it is to some degree socially acceptable to be an addict. Remember, I mean, God only knows how many people went through the 70s, fucked out of their minds on cocaine or heroin or God knows what. You know what I mean? So it's one of those things where you just sort of, it's a quirk, it's a side effect, it's a bug that you learn to deal with. If they keep making records and somebody keeps rolling in, they'll tolerate pretty much anything.
Yeah, man.
I mean, if Wayne had been a lawyer or a doctor or an accountant, not so much.
What about this makeshift little vocal booth that Lane had with a dead dog or something in it? I can't remember what
dead puppy, like a puppy here.
This is actually a puppy in a glass and formaldehyde, like from one of those.
Yeah, not actual dog. It's like a puppy fetus. Yeah, I think it was a puppy fetus. Yeah, if I remember correctly. Yeah, it's like the Last Supper, scented candle, the puppy in the jar, and I can't remember what else. And that's sort of a. He sets up this makeshift booth so they can't see him from the outside while he's singing, right? And so, inside, I guess, to get him the headspace that he needed, that's the thing that he created. I don't know what he was thinking, but I mean, the studio staff and Jordan all confirmed it.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Jordan, he had a bit of a come-to-Jesus moment with Lane during the recording, and while it upset Lane at the time, and they had a a sort of reckoning shortly after, but it seemed to help. Like, Lane apparently was coming in, as much as Lane was a great singer, he was coming in unprepared, maybe a little too hungover or fucked up, something like that.
Because remember, Lane multi-tracked his vocals, right? So it's like he's like doing like 3-4-part harmonies, whatever.
Right.
And that requires a great deal of concentration and precision. And, you know, he was fucked up and he just wasn't hitting it, you know? Whereas, now, one thing you have to remember also is that Jordan did the first two records, right? He did Faceless and Burn. No Harold in Burn Faceless. Everyone involved with that record, I spoke to, said it. There's nothing there. They came to work. They bought their A-game every day, you know? And Alice, by the time we got to the studio, one account that is fairly consistent, all of them across the board, was that when they came ready to work and they had their parts down, I mean, they were just very efficient. One or two takes, that was it, you know? So for Lane to come in to the studio and just start blowing takes, you know, Jordan's like, what the hell is going on here? You know what I mean? And so that's where they have this, they have a sort of blow up. Lane runs out of the studio. And then, you know, they have a phone call. So Susan calls Jordan, and then Jordan calls him. Jordan calls Lane to sort of pass things up and like, look, I'm not trying to judge you. I just wanted to make the best record possible, and I want you to nail your take. That's it. And so that's sort of, it was after they had that talk that, you know, Lane came ready to work, and he started getting takes.
And correct me if I'm wrong, there is, I don't recall reading a reference. I read the book when it came out, and I just kind of went back and reread kind of this little chunk getting ready for this. I don't remember you talking about Jerry using heroin. There's a reason I'm asking. Am I right in that, or do I just misremember that?
Some people who were, I'd rather not get into it. I couldn't prove it conclusively that he did.
Oh, you sure? Yeah.
So, I've never heard of that.
So my memory is right that there's nothing in the book that way.
No, I mean, Jerry had his own drug issues, but to my knowledge, it wasn't heroin. I don't know if he ever tried it, but I'm assuming it's theoretically possible, but I don't know that he ever tried. I never found a quote from anybody saying, you know, yes, Jerry was, you know, fine, or he was shooting up his lane, okay, or whatever. I never found anything like that at all. I heard rumors or, you know, gossip that he did, but again, I couldn't prove it, so I just left it out.
Okay.
So I could answer that question. I can't answer that question one way or the other.
The reason I ask is because his solo album Degradation Trip is one of the records on this list, and we already went through it, and that is some of the to me that's almost a sequel to Dirt, and it's actually darker at points.
He is full blown down his rabbit hole at that point. Yeah, if you remember the album cover, it's like a hand, you know, with like the strings coming out of the arm or whatever.
It's a fucked up cover.
And it came out right after Lane died too, so keep that in mind.
Yeah, and at the time I thought it was about Lane, but one of the guys that we've had on the show is Jeff Tamay, the producer. And
oh wow.
And he never flat out said it, but he definitely talked about like how hard it was to work with Jerry at the time, which years earlier, when you talk about Dave Jordan and stuff like that working on these first few records, that's not really the case. And by the way, by hard, I mean it was like schedule, things like that, as a personality. But it seemed like there was this darker side of shit that was going on with Jerry personally with addiction.
When he made that record, I guess from 98 to about 03, whatever, that was sort of his bottom, the hip bottom.
Yep.
I don't know what his drug is. I mean, ultimately, I heard it from about a dozen different sources what his problem was, to the point where I felt comfortable doing it, but because what I ultimately decided was that because, you know, for some strange reason, he's never openly admitted or talked about his drug addiction, but doesn't say what the drug was. I don't know how you rationale for how he grew up in every quote I've ever seen of him talking about his drug addiction, like even like at the Music Cares, you know, ceremony where he got Artist of the Year, whatever, he never talks about the drug. And so,
okay.
You know, it ultimately, you know, I don't know, that's how he feels about it. Ultimately, I chose that to respect his privacy and not sort of, you know, out him or, you know, reveal this. But you know, that's ultimately kind of why I didn't mention that and mention the specifics of what he was into at the time. But
I can respect that.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like he was a politician or something like that, or being a Bible thumper and hypocrite or whatever, you know. So I ultimately just sort of said, all right, well, I'll let that one slide.
And this ain't that kind of show. I'm never trying to get people to say something that's going to put them in a bad light or things of that nature, you know. But one other story I really enjoyed was when Lane had to leave a video shoot to go feed his cat.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen that movie, American Psycho?
Yeah.
You remember every time I can't remember the name. Is it Patrick Bateman, the main character?
Christian Bale. Yeah.
Oh, Christian Bale. He has to return videos all the time.
Got to return some videotapes.
Oh, God. I didn't remember that. No. But the funny thing is, you know, I had just got, when I was writing this book, I got a cat. I got my own cat. That was the first time I ever had a cat, right? And so when I heard that, I started laughing my ass off because I'm like, dude, there's no way. I mean, it's not like it's a dog or something like that. Like, a cat will sit there and feed itself and not give a shit. They'll just sleep around the house all day. You know what
I mean? I've taken vacations without worrying about feeding my cat, but
yeah, so it's like, if it's one of those things that I guess, like, anybody who was at that shoe was like, yeah, right.
I'm sorry, guys. I have to go feed my cat. It's like right now. Do you still have the cat? Is it still alive?
That's Sadie. I think that was Sadie. That's the only cat I've ever found out about him having had it. But it's like, that's a thing. I don't know if I don't know. He may have been thinking about it. I don't know. Because, like, I know he has Sadie in 94. He had the cat in 94. In fact,
I was asking about your cat. You said you had just gotten the cat.
Oh, my cat. I'm sorry. No. I got my cat's like 7 now, but I got him while I was still working on this book.
Yeah, right? Same cat though, right?
Yeah, still same cat. Yeah.
What's the name?
My cat's name Moscow. It's a Russian breed. It's called a Siberian.
Oh,
so
wow.
Get a Russian name.
Hey, you didn't think we were going to talk about your cat this much, did you?
No, I thought we were talking about Lane's cat. In fact, I was going to tell you about Lane's cat.
No, we can talk about Lane's cat. Yeah. So there is speculation that he might not have had a cat at the time, right?
Here's what I was able to. I couldn't definitively prove it or disprove it, but if you think about it, here's what I know. By 94, when they finished, remember, 93 is the last year they do major touring with Lane, right? The end of the dirt cycle, right? 94, they do Jar of Flies. They do a couple of one-off shows. And then, you know, they're supposed to tour Metallica, and then they pull out, right? And then that's when the band goes on hiatus and then goes mad season. And then a year later, in 95, they do the Dog album, right?
Yeah.
So for about a year and a half, 2 years, in the studio. So in 94, I know from his roommate and from a girl he was hanging out at the time that he had his cat. His cat, Sadie. In fact, one of the interesting things, a few months or years after my book came out, a friend of Wayne and Gundy's contacted me, and she was the one that gave him the cat. It was funny, but it was a Russian blue Siamese mix. He picked the girl, and he named it Sadie. So anyway, long story short, so in 94, you know, he's living in this apartment in Queen Anne, in the Queen Anne neighborhood in Seattle. And that's when, you know, Johnny Bacolus moved in with him. The band wasn't active. They weren't touring. He was sitting there, whatever. And, you know, in 92, you know, he's doing this shoot for Wood. It's the Wood video. It's at a club in Seattle called Under the Rail. It doesn't exist anymore. And so keep in mind at that point, like, they had gone up from, they were, I think, in the middle of the dirt. They were in the middle of the dirt sessions. And we went back to Seattle for like a week so we could do this video shoot and take care of stuff over there. And then they had to go back to LA to finish the album, right? So the point I'm trying to make here is that Alice was active at that time. They were recording, they were touring, whatever. And I don't know where, I think Lane had an apartment with Demi at that point, but I don't think, and keep in mind, Demi was touring with him sometimes as well. So I don't think there would have been a whole lot of time to take care of a cat. So, I mean, I can't 100% disprove it. All I'm telling you is that if you look at the events in his life in 92 versus 94, I just don't think he could have had a cat in 92.
We're going to
be too busy working and touring.
Oh, yeah, and I think as two people who both own cats, we can both safely say he did not have to leave and feed his cat with any certain immediacy.
No.
So we know the cat would have been okay if it waited a few hours a day or even two.
Yeah, exactly. And as long as you leave, you know, the can of dry food and a bowl of water out, they don't care. It's all looking like a dog where they eat everything. And they leave
I know.
You know. They leave the dish dry, you know what I mean? So, yeah.
It'd be hilarious if it turns out like he's been forgetting to feed his cat for like a week, and he actually had a valid point. He's like, fuck, what if it's dead?
Well, that might have actually happened, because he was the one that was dead.
Yeah, well, there's that. Well, let me ask you this. Now, did you ever reach out to any of the members of, I guess at this point it would have been Jerry or Sean, any of the members of the band to be, you know?
I did.
And how did that go?
I did. I reached out to them through several channels, through their lawyer, their management, the publicist, and then ultimately one of my sources gave me Susan Silver's contact information. I reached out through all four of them, and I never heard back. So I took that as a giant no comment.
Are you aware of any comments they may have had about the book after it came out?
I'd rather not discuss that. There's some off-the-record stuff.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'd rather,
nothing
I'd
on the record, comment. Like they didn't say anything about it in an interview or anything like
no,
that?
No, I don't know. I was kind of expecting for an explosion or something like that. I honestly don't, you know, no, I mean, no official reaction. And, you know, again, they haven't contacted me, and I don't know. So it's, you know.
Well, you didn't get sued, right? So it turns out you probably didn't publish any lies.
Well, don't poke the bear, right?
Well, I flat out tell you, anybody who reads this book with an open mind and takes it for what it is, you do a great job of separating things that you were able to verify versus things that, like, there's some gray area here. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and there was some stuff that we had to just either take out or either because we took out because you couldn't conclusively prove it. Or just the sourcing wasn't enough. Like I had one source and they wanted like two or three or whatever. I don't know. There was something that got taken out by the lawyers in the editing process. But for the most part, it's all there. Right? I mean, most of it's on the record, either attributed to a person or to a document, right? And the great thing about a lot of my source material was official, government documents. You know, police and court records, medical examiner's reports. Whatever I could get my hands on. Now, this is sort of journalism, media law 101, but the reason why journalists love these records is because if you accurately report what is in an official government document, you cannot get sued for defamation or libel. So,
Well, right, that's why, it's an official, that makes sense.
That's why journalists or lawyers love public records. So, and I made quite extensive use of those in the book. And, that's why my lawyer's like, oh my God, this is one of the easiest edits I've ever had to do. Because we have so many documents. So,
well, let me get your opinion on a couple things. Do you think Dirt's a pro drug record? Because I got a lot of shit for it.
Because you get a lot of shit or they get a lot of shit.
When that record came out, I'm not talking now. I'm talking about like when the album came out. I recall there being a lot of kind of like blowback. Like this is basically a drug endorsement album. I personally didn't take it that way. I'm just asking for your opinion on that.
Lane has there's a quote there. He said, I had fans come up to me saying, yeah, I tried heroin, it was awesome. And that's exactly what I didn't want. You know what I mean? And so, and that's how he felt about it. Now, as far as the record goes, if you look at it, it's not a concept record, even though it feels and sounds like one. It's just the whole thing. It's kind of like, even though Sgt. Pepper wasn't, there's no concept behind it. It's not like one, that there's one sort of cohesive, even though
great comparison.
Kind of over the place. But yeah, you listen to like Them Bones, it's about death. You listen to, Rain When I Die, it's about death. You listen to Down in a Hole, I think it was about Jerry's girlfriend at the time. You listen to, Rooster, it's about Jerry's father in Vietnam, And then you go, I guess in those days it was on cassette or, vinyl now, but if you flip to the second side, that's, I guess, where the Lane rehab songs come in, Sick Man, Junkhead, Godsmack, all those, and they're played in this sequence of like four songs.
Yeah.
And that sort of overshadows the entire record, which is already pretty freaking dark in and of itself. Right?
You're not wrong. No.
That second half of the record, and it culminates with Wood. Even though Wood is not part of that cycle, Wood was its own separate song written, for the singles movie. But it's a progression in the sense, that like it starts out like, hey, this is awesome, to oh my god, I'm screwed. if you look at the lyrical progression of those four songs, and there's a famous, I think it was that famous line in Hate to Feel, I think, which would have been the last in the cycle, the words, he realizes he made a mistake. And I'm just wondering if that's, I don't know how wholly autobiographical it is, but, that's sort of the cycle. So it can be easy to see how it got interpreted that way. And it, to the point where Lane's heroin use, the fact that he openly admitted it, he talked about it in interviews, overshadowed the rest of the band for the rest of his life.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's easy to see how and why, it's easy to see how and why people come off with that idea, and it's kind of like, it's kind of like when people, give Taylor Swift all this crap about ask her about her love life. I'm like, and she's like, why do you care? He's like, well, when you write all these songs trashing your ex-boyfriends, I'm sorry, that's their game. It's your work. That's what you're talking about, Same deal with Alice and Jane, And he starts talking about, write songs about heroin. And he starts talking about heroin in the press. And guess what? And then he realizes that, everyone's asking about heroin. And so he stops talking to the press. And then, more rumors start, So it's kind of this, sort of this vicious cycle between, I guess he thought he was being honest and maybe a little too honest for his own good, quite frankly. And then he didn't realize just how much of an impact it was going to have on the entire band. Just the pall, there was this cloud over the band from that point on until Lane died. And even then it didn't end because Mike died a couple of years later. So it was, thankfully, Jerry and Sean are still with us, and they got rid of their bad habits. But look at all the stuff they had to go through to get there.
Oh yeah, no doubt. The other thing I wanted your opinion on, as someone who wrote this book, do you think it's easier or harder to write a book without the contributions of those that are directly involved? I guess I'm talking about Jerry and Sean. Do you think it was easier to write this book without Alice in Chains being part of the project?
Well, I'll say this. Journalists and historians do this all the time. I'm not the first one to do it either. One of my favorite books of all time is Killing Pablo by Mark Bowden. I don't know if you ever read it.
Nope.
It's a story of Pablo Escobar and the Colombian drug war. Came out like 15, 20 years ago. It's like 200 something pages. It's very quick, but it's one of those books where, you know, before Narcos and before all that stuff came out, like, that was the book to read, right? So, you know, again, he didn't have access to Pablo Escobar, but you know what? He went, he researched it, he probably got sources, and he wrote the hell out of that story. And, you know, again, no collaboration with, no participation with the subject, right? You know, how many books have been written about Jimi Hendrix? You know, all of them, you know, he died at 27. And you know, there, you know, none of them were with his participation. So, I mean, it's, you know, you can get around it. It can be done. And so, I mean, I knew from, you know, I mean,
some artists, if they get too involved, are going to kind of shape the story the way they want it. Is kind of where I was going.
Right, exactly. Then that's sort of the trade, the balancing act you have to make, because, you know, if you get the access, sure, you know, that'll open a lot of doors for you. On the other hand, you know, depending on what arrangement you have, you know, they may want some editorial control over it, and they may water it down. They may, you know, because, like, again, it's, you know, it's a difference between sort of an investigative piece, an investigative book, or, you know, a book length, you know, press release. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's one of those things where,
which is every KISS book ever written.
I want my book to be, you know, a gushy fanboy tribute. That's not what my book is. I didn't want it to be, you know, tabloid, you know, trash. I mean, if you read the British tabloids, those people are ruthless. You know, they spare nothing. And, you know, I didn't want it to be bad either. So you just sort of have to find this delicate sort of middle ground where, you know, you get the important issues of the story, you cover the darker elements as best as you can without being exploitative. I mean, there were certainly some stories about, you know, the junkie lifestyle that I wound up leaving out of the book just because they added nothing other than shock value, in my opinion.
Okay.
So I just left the, because it had nothing to do with the band. It's just, you know, stuff that you could see or read in any memoir or movie or documentary or whatever. It's nothing, you know, it doesn't add any understanding or relevance to, you know, the broader Alice in Chains story. You know, what I tried to limit my focus, for example, was how was the drugs affecting your ability to function, right, as a unit, whether they were in the studio or on the road. That was absolutely fair game, in my opinion. And, you know, and then also, how was it affecting them personally, internal dynamics, you know, friendships, families, business partnerships, all that, you know. But as far as this drugs, for, you know, a scene of, you know, Wayne or Mike shooting up just for the sake of putting it in there, no, it's not there. Every drug scene or reference is in there for a reason, because it adds context or understanding to a broader point about what was going on in the band at that point. And, you know, it adds to the understanding of the bigger story. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, it makes sense. It kind of hammers home a point that I was trying to make early on that basically I agree with everything you said. And my Lord, you have been so generous with your time. I would like to mention that the book is called Alice in Chains, The Untold Story. It's not hard to find, people. Just go Google it. You'll find it. The author I'm talking to, of course, is David Asola. David, thank you so much for sharing your stories of this. This was a book that I needed, that's for sure. And you delivered, and you did it in a way that I don't know, people who listen to this interview are going to hear it too. You're pretty honest and open. You admit, like, well, maybe this did or didn't happen. I kind of like that. How locked down is Georgia right now? Are most things open? Is it kind of like, can you report on that at all?
I live in Atlanta. I live in, like, Midtown Atlanta, which is kind of like the equivalent of, like, Manhattan.
Okay.
So it's like, you know, a lot of high rises and things like that. It's near Georgia Tech. So it's, you know, it's a lot of, you know, educated people who, you know, who practice social distancing. They wear masks everywhere, you know. And, you know, for the most part, the people are kind of respectful about it. But, like, you know, I haven't seen anybody, like, you know, like you see those videos on YouTube or whatever, people having tantrums at, like, you know.
I haven't witnessed it either. I've never really seen any rudeness with it personally. It's unbelievable.
I haven't seen that yet either. I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but Georgia has one of the highest rates of new COVID cases in the country of any state. Right. So, you know, it's something that I do take seriously, and, you know, you try to take measures. I mean, I have a cousin who is still recovering from her bout with COVID, and, you know, bless her, she's doing okay, but I mean, she's 37, 38, and she has, you know, fibrosis and a collapsed lung she's still recovering from. You know, it's not it's nothing to mess with. Yeah. So it's not something I'd wish on anybody, and, you know, I hope you know all those, you know, anti-mask lunatics out there who are, you know, preaching and saying it's, you know, freedom and whatever. I'm like, dude, you do not want to mess with this. It doesn't care about your politics. It is purely, it's all about, you know, biology, chemistry, and physics. That's it. So, you know, moral of the story, you know, socially isolate, wear your mask, you know, wash your hands, you know, stay safe.
I fully endorse your comments there. That's not what I was laughing at all. Switching gears a little bit, I wanted to mention one thing for anybody and by the way, if you're a fan of Alice in Chains, you should absolutely get this book if you already haven't. But be prepared, easy for me to say. Have your Kindle, your laptop, or something handy, because when I read this book, I was constantly bumping to YouTube to go catch up on something that you mentioned. And also, your website, if you could mention the web address here quickly, has a ton of great YouTube clips of different things with Alice in Chains that people can check out that kind of adds to the enjoyment. It's daviddesola.com, is that right?
That is correct, yeah. So a lot of the research I did was, you know, again, God bless the internet, you know, people, yep. Fans over the years have uploaded, you know, TV performances and interviews and bootlegs and, you know, whatever. And so there's all the stuff that I use and I cite it as material, and I mentioned it in my footnotes. And then, you know, but obviously a book is only so much you can do. I mean, you have to be like a super nerd to go back there, copy your best down, and type it into a browser. So I figured it'd be easier if I just made a section on my website where I could just sort of dump all this stuff and people could just sort of start looking at some of these videos. And I think, if I remember correctly, some of the stuff that's in there is, you know, like the Mike Starr last show with Alice in Chains. I think there might be some videos of Sleeve in there. One of the most significant historical finds was a bootleg audio recording of a Alice in Chains show. It's a Wayne Glam band in Tacoma in 1987. And Jerry Cantrell was in the crowd that night. So, I mean, what you're really listening to this, even though it's not the best quality recording, but it's what you're listening is what a young Jerry Cantrell heard the first time he saw and heard Wayne Stiller perform live. So keep that in mind.
David, this could not have gone better. You know, these have all been really gone good and been a lot of fun. But, you know, we've never talked before, so you never really know what you're getting into. So
yeah.
I could not appreciate your time more. And, and thank you for the content.
No, thank you.
I'm not afraid to die.
Well, I'm always looking for that because that you may not know, but there's a few Soundgarden records coming up here. So,
I would figure that's why I'm like, who are you talking to for Soundgarden, right? Yeah.
Hey, you know what?
Events.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.